I really did not anticipate that we would see what we saw, which was not only the really terrible rise and rapid rise in cases, but really the dysfunctionality of our health system.
I don't think anyone could have predicted this.
Younger adults can get infected.
The coinciding infection with COVID-19.
They're looking for answers that aren't there.
You're not feeling well because you did test positive for COVID-19.
This is Global Health in the Time of COVID, a miniseries brought to you by the Institute for Global Health Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco. Produced in collaboration with Carry the One Radio. Welcome back to Global Health in the Time of COVID, a series from Carry the One Radio. I'm Ben Mansky. In this week's episode, we're talking about how the COVID-19 pandemic has altered global health education, why the U.S.'s pandemic response has fallen short, and what we can learn from looking abroad. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought to light huge systemic problems in American healthcare: disparities in access, a lack of protective equipment, and confusing and inconsistent communication to the public. It's a particularly complex time for scientists and clinicians in global health as they manage research, clinical practice, and teaching in the face of a global health challenge unlike anything many of us have ever seen. How will this change the way the next generations of global health professionals are trained? And how will our healthcare system change as a result? To find out, CTOR producer Nancy Kaya and I spoke to Dr. Madhavi Dandu, director of UCSF's master's program in global health, and Dr. Elizabeth Fair, director of UCSF's global health PhD program. This interview was conducted on May 28, 2020.
My name is Madhavi Dandu, and I'm a professor of medicine in the Department of Medicine and the Division of Hospital Medicine here at UCSF. And I'm also program director for the Master of Science in Global Health program, which is located at the Institute for Global Health Science, where I'm also a faculty member.
My name is Elizabeth Fair. I'm an associate professor of medicine. My faculty appointment is in the Department of Medicine as well. I'm in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine based out of Zuckerberg, San Francisco General. I'm also affiliated with the UCSF Center for Tuberculosis. And the other hat I wear, parallel to Madhavi, is I'm the director of the PhD program in global health in the Institute for Global Health Sciences.
To start, what kind of work does each of you do as a researcher or clinician, and how has that changed with the advent of the pandemic?
My clinical environment is an inpatient clinical environment. So basically, I take care of adults who are hospitalized. And I do that in the academic setting with residents and medical students, and sometimes other health professional students as well. So that structure hasn't changed per se at all since the transition in our with COVID-19. However, the environment has definitely changed in a lot of ways. For a while, we didn't have our medical students, especially our third-year medical students, were not able to stay onto our teams for the early part. Another big and really significant change has been the ways in which we interact with our patients and their families. So one of the most gratifying elements of inpatient medical care, other than, you know, the opportunity to do interesting work, is really relationship building with patients and their families. But unfortunately, with COVID-19 and the need to protect our patients and our staff as well as their families, we haven't had visitors. And that means a lot of things, a lot of difficulty with communication, patient loneliness, and really a lot of efforts to combat the high-risk situation that our already vulnerable patients, for example, people who are not English language speakers or who are have a history of dementia or other memory disorders, et cetera, who would already be vulnerable, now become even more vulnerable because they don't have patients or family at their side. So that has been a transition that has been quite a difficult one, emotionally for the patients and the families and our staff, but also has led us to think a lot about how are we going to adjust to the new normal and think of creative ways to interact. And we had a lot of support from staff and medical students and other people to be really creative about communication, iPads at the bedside, and really commitments to communicating with patients and their families, and advocating for those situations in which having someone at the bedside is absolutely necessary, worth the risk of COVID.
Elizabeth, the kind of research that you do and how it's changed?
So I am trained as an infectious disease epidemiologist, which it's an interesting time. People finally know what an epidemiologist are in the public. Most of my research is focused on tuberculosis. I've worked in TB research for about 25 years now. And interestingly, my focus in the last decade or so has really been TB active case finding. So about 3 million cases every year of TB, they're not diagnosed. They're not reported to health systems. And so a really standard approach to that is active case finding and specifically contact investigation. It's an age-old public health approach. I've worked with WHO in developing policy guidelines for this. It's really not rocket science. It's an interesting time now, though, because all of a sudden with COVID, both here in the United States and in high resource, low resource settings, people are talking about contact tracing and the need for that. And so that's been an interesting shift just in terms of sort of awareness of these really important basic public health approaches to active case finding, disease surveillance, that kind of thing. Specifically, I've got a project I'm working very actively on in Mozambique right now. I've been working there for about 4 years with a fantastic team and focused on TB contact investigation. And so we're, you know, working really hard right now to catch up to, we were about to start implementation, working also with a team from WHO on TB contact investigation using mobile apps for enhancing contact investigation, but really thinking about, well, if we have community health workers going to people's households, screening just for TB and COVID is, you know, still the numbers are very uncertain there. The diagnostics are different. The screening is different. Access to those kind of things is very different. So we're trying to figure out how we can very quickly pivot and integrate some COVID basic education, training, maybe some screening to try to help with the surveillance efforts in this small project we have, but also, you know, communicating with the Ministry of Health there to see what their standard practice is, you know, the resources, what they have in terms of PPE is different. So it's been a rapid education. It's, you know, in one ways, it's very parallel in terms of the case finding that we do for TB. And in the other sense, it's, you know, COVID's a very different disease and different mitigation. So it's been challenging, but intellectually very interesting, but practically really challenging to figure out how to, you know, support people the best we can with the resources that we have.
That sounds like a challenge, but also like having already been in the sort of contact tracing arena, maybe some of the strategies are a little more clear than the current state of the United States would have you believe.
Exactly. Exactly. I think it's pretty accepted in so many other settings. And I think it's also, you know, there's a much bigger dialogue, too, especially in low resource settings around things like TB, HIV, malaria, of how this is going to impact the other diseases in addition to COVID, of not too many people completely shifting all of the resources to COVID. But, you know, those other diseases are still a significant health challenge. So how to balance and allocate resources given limited situations.
How did each of you get to public health? What was your path like?
Well, so my path came through my work as a physician. So I think I was probably always interested in population level or public health. I did a combined undergraduate medical degree program at the University of Michigan, and I had an opportunity there to do my undergraduate focus actually in comparative literature, but the focus was really on post-colonial literature and kind of the structures and systems that I think lead to a lot of our current health issues. And so I definitely did not describe it that way when I was going through it when I was younger, but I think all of it came together to lead to this understanding that I would now describe as the deep intersection between structural determinants of health and individual health. I was lucky to train in residency here where I had the opportunity to really interact with structures and systems, both in a good way and in the difficult ways of seeing the ways our patients struggled and suffered from systemic issues. So I was able to then, when I was done with residency, able to go to Berkeley to complete a public health degree. My focus was an interdisciplinary focus because my interest was in global health, or what we called international health at that time, and health and human rights. And what I really wanted to understand was the framework, or a framework, or several frameworks I could use to both explain or help explain the inequities we saw in care and also think about ways to advocate and reverse some of those structures that were both at the bedside and outside of that. So I did that in public health school. And then, you know, as time and careers evolved and global health became a field, I had the opportunity also at the same time think about that as an intersected with education. So I kind of had the opportunity to be sort of clinician, educator, public health person, working to, you know, all of it together, mostly working and thinking about structural determinants of health and impact on patients.
I think my entry into public health and global health really started out of raw curiosity. I had the opportunity to I took a year off before going to college and just really was curious about the world and wanted a different experience outside of academia before jumping into college. So I spent a year in Western Kenya teaching English. And I think that just sort of opened my eyes to all kinds of different health disparities, whole different culture, just such a different perspective of the world that I had growing up. And so I think that sort of raw experience really informed my academic path from that step forward. I ended up undergrad as an anthropology and African studies major. I spent a year studying abroad again while I was an undergrad, and then knew I wanted to keep working in internationally, the field of global health. So then I spent a year working in Bangladesh, and that's where I was introduced to tuberculosis. That was my first TB project, and I've honestly been working in TB ever since. And then that led me to sort of, I was a researcher there and realized I didn't know enough to do any good research. So I went on and did my MPH, and again, sought some more experiences after my training and my master's in public health, where I focused in population and family health, because again, there still wasn't a global health option. I wanted to work after that, so I ended up at CDC in a fellowship for a couple of years, and then knew I just, again, needed to learn more to be able to do what I wanted to do. So I did my PhD in infectious disease epidemiology at Stanford Medical School. As Madhavi said, none of my formal academic training, there was an offering for global health. There was some international health, but really not much. And I think that's why the hats that we wear now as program directors for global health education is so exciting, because it's sort of, you finally get to build what you wish you had all along.
Definitely. And it seems like there's an unmet need for a specific global health education in the world in general today. So talking more about your roles as educators, how do you think like formalizing all of this sort of training that you had to cobble together under a global health umbrella, like how do you think it streamlines or changes the training experience?
One really big challenge we had was in the beginning was, what do we include in global health, and is it all the same as public health? Does it have certain philosophical values? Does it have certain structural values, et cetera? And I think by developing as a field, we've been able to create community among professionals and educators to really decide what we think are key goals and competencies. And that was really done, you know, through collaboration, mostly across the United States, but with a significant effort to think about our global partners as well. And then for students, actually community building and being with other people who are like-minded and people who are really diverse in their backgrounds, interests, and skills, but are moving towards the same goal. So being able to learn and work with people in an interdisciplinary manner. But then also community building that leads to career development.
The master's program was one of the first master's programs in the United States in global health. So really has been sort of a leader in what the curriculum is, what the competencies are, what a master's in global health really is. I think of it as a gold standard in many ways. And I think the PhD program is much newer. So we're only in our fourth year. So I think similar challenges in terms of defining the field. I think if you asked, you know, 10 people what global health is just as a definition, you're going to get 10 different definitions. For the PhD standpoint, I think there's so many different research or methods, approaches to studying global health that sort of trying to put that into a box. There is a lot of flexibility in someone saying, well, I really want a, you know, a traditional clinical approach to global health research versus anthropological approach versus, you know, more implementation science. So it is really exciting to be kind of building it and defining it as we go. And our students are really sort of the examples of what that looks like.
I'm guessing that there's probably been some changes given the COVID-19 pandemic in the way that your programs are administered or implemented. What kinds of changes have you experienced and how are you adapting to this situation?
Yes, absolutely. There have been a lot of changes since the onset of COVID. I think probably at the most simplified level, we are no longer able to be in the classroom together. So all of our spring classes went online immediately. But I think the education environment changed in a lot of ways, because part of what I went back to when I was talking about how the value of this field of global health is the community piece. And so our classes are all discussion-based. Our classes are all focused on, you know, paired or large group or small group work. Discussions, debates, even articulation of your own work is done with peer support or peer critique. And so we had to figure out how to do that, you know, remotely. It is possible. Clearly, there are programs that have done that. And so we were able to think about ways in which we could create opportunities or facilitate student opportunities to do that themselves or with us. But in addition, I think the two hardest areas have been the supporting the real emotional distress and transition that students, faculty, all of us were feeling and staff were feeling, and supporting the positive outside of that, which is that normally this period of time for us is a real opportunity for networking and career development for our students.
Yeah, I would just add from our side of things, it's slightly different. We have a much smaller cohort of students than Madhavi has. Almost half of our students are international students. So figuring out just ability to travel, to be in a different country doing the research that they had planned to do, that's a huge challenge and obviously off the table for right now. Other students, whether it's to return home or not return home. So just the really logistical geography questions, as well as readjusting their expectations of what research they'll be able to accomplish. But the flip side is we're all students of global health, and this is a once in a generation pandemic. So, while logistically there are huge challenges, and, as Madhavi said, we're doing our best to support our students and continue to engage them in ways because of the opportunity to be at UCSF. But I think it's also intellectually, this is their moment of really challenged to think about a lot of the real life implications, the research implications, the global implications of what is happening in this world. Is such a unique time that, I think I find it really inspiring to have conversations with our students and our faculty about what's happening and how to sort of process these things, because it's unprecedented.
Elizabeth, you reminded me of something that was very important, which is that, none of our students could do the projects exactly the way they had planned, or most of them couldn't. And so, with the reality that travel in particular, which is often important for global health, whether domestic or international, or even interaction with participants, study participants or otherwise, is a key element of research, this not being able to happen, or for most people not being able to happen in a way that was effective, I think challenges us to think about issues that honestly we've been thinking about for a long time. And those issues really relate to I think three categories of things when I think about it. One is, what is the role of a learner in these settings? But fundamentally, the goal for the learner is, to learn a certain set of skills. And those skills range from, technical skills, so epidemiologic skills, quantitative, qualitative research skills, to cultural humility, to communication, to, effective writing skills, et cetera. And so part of what we have to do is think about, how do you still do that without the structures in place that we've had before? So that is one big piece. A second category is, how do we intersect and interact with our partners who we rely on a lot to continue to, especially help our trainees in the experiential portion of their work. And so how do we do that? How do we continue to do that? And do we use this time to further challenge ourselves, as we've already been doing, to reset the dynamics that are unfortunately historically perpetuated by some of the things that we do in global health? And so this is, seems like a good time to reset on that. So I'll give just a really concrete example, which is that, you know, our students might be working on a project, and maybe they were going to go to a place and be a part of interviews. So they wouldn't be able to do the interviews if they don't speak the language, et cetera, but they'd be part of these interviews, and then they would have this data. They might work with their mentors in a thoughtful way, write it up. Hopefully it'll be communicated at the community level and, you know, meet those kind of goals. But maybe had we all the way along, and some projects had this, always partnered with a trainee on site in X country or Y country or X location or Y location, then, you know, it didn't become dependent on our student being there to move the project forward. Now, that's something we've thought about for a long time, and it's something that we sometimes do, but, you know, maybe now that becomes more of a reality because we should have always been doing that, but because that's also what might be, the, you know, the future of what global health looks like. And then finally, just as a third category, I think while we, I think, deeply have always held that global health is both international and domestic in its structures and systems and values, the reality is that people often focus on our international relationships and partnerships and international work. And, you know, COVID has brought home and reminded people that the work that we do is very local.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, it sounds like it's given a lot of time for reflection about the program and just global health in general and how to redesign the system or redesign the programs in general. What was your first reaction, or what was the context in which you first heard about the COVID-19 pandemic?
I remember hearing about it for the first time. I was at a symposium over at Berkeley on emerging and neglected diseases, and there was this fantastic panel in the morning focused on Ebola, actually, and some fabulous speakers from, you know, all over the country. And there was one conversation around One Health and the interaction between sort of the animal-human interface, and someone made a comment about there's this really interesting coronavirus, you know, spreading in China. And it was sort of this one of these moments where like half the audience had heard about it and, you know, responded. And the other half, I remember hearing about it because I hadn't heard about it yet, but clearly there were people in the know. So I was remembering that the other day, and I went back and looked up, and that the symposium was on like January 9th or 10th. So that was right when the cases were beginning to be reported. Because I remember then asking people afterwards, I was like, have you heard about this? And, you know, it really wasn't public knowledge quite yet. I mean, now we know the time frame of what was happening in Wuhan and have a better picture then. But I remember distinctly sort of being like, oh, these people are in the know. They know what's going on. And you know, all of a sudden, obviously, a couple weeks later, it was all over the news. So it was an interesting, it's interesting to know the exact moment. It wasn't like it just kind of, you read the New York Times and sort of hear it there. But amongst experts in infectious diseases, neglected diseases, all discussing it, it was pretty fascinating.
For me, I think I was more of a traditional, I read it in the news before I really felt it here kind of person. And then at the same time, probably, you know, a little earlier than had I not been in the clinical setting, because I was in the clinical setting, I, you know, we were already starting to talk a little bit about systems and structures in the inpatient setting and sort of what would begin to happen, you know, but my initial understanding of it really just came from a combination of news media and some scientific literature that was beginning to come out.
Did either of you ever expect it to come to the U.S.?
So when Ebola was happening, you know, I underwent the clinical training systems here, and you know, I'm of the mindset, or my belief is that anything can happen and can come here. So I did suspect it, but I really did not anticipate that we would see what we saw, which was not only the really terrible rise and rapid rise in cases, but really the dysfunctionality of our health system. I know that the system's dysfunctional. It doesn't treat our patients, and not everyone gets the same level of care, but you know, we have a really pretty strong public health infrastructure in San Francisco. And you know, I know a lot of really wonderful public health people who've been thinking about all this, and it shook all of that. So definitely, I did not expect what we saw.
No, I didn't. I don't think anyone could have predicted this. Although I did, I mean, trained as an infectious disease epidemiologist, I sort of went back cataloging all the ID epi classes I've taken in my master's and PhD, and kind of thinking about the number of case studies as a student that I read of, like, the big challenge will be flu. And, you know, having read, obviously, books about the 1918 flu pandemic, and as a historical case study, and people really warning that that is going to be the thing that's going to be a massive threat to our health system, but never really could have imagined what has actually happened, and a lot of what Madhavi just said in terms of the political leadership. And you know, I spent a few years at CDC. I loved working at CDC, and that was a long time ago, and sort of being surprised in terms of kind of having all this faith in the systems that we should have in place, and how what has not been enacted is pretty shocking, not to get too political.
Thank you both for your responses. And I think, I know you said not to get too political, but the next question might bring that up a little bit. So, out of curiosity, why do you think some countries are more successful at containing the spread than others? For example, like South Korea and New Zealand were maybe better than US, Italy, and Brazil.
It's definitely a political conversation, so I'm okay with that. But so when I think about it, a few things. One has to do with planning, infrastructure, systems. You know, the fact that we didn't have adequate PPE for the start has a lot to do with start infrastructure and planning, and the will to have systems in place to invest in something that might never happen or might not happen right away. So part of that is, has to do with investments. Part of it has to do in the same way with infrastructure, with our very fragmented, disjointed, really devastatingly dysfunctional health system, which, you know, while our quality of care in any individual setting might be particularly good or high, you know, how people get care, why people get care, how care is paid for, how communication happens is, you know, always been a failure of our system, which has been also further amplified by this. With one part has to do with infrastructure and preparation. I think a second part is a bit cultural. Like, there are some really wonderful aspects of our desire to honor and maintain people's privacy and individuality and respect for the dignity of individuals. And, you know, the other side of that is that some countries which have done a really good job have really strong systems of monitoring and, you know, cell phone monitoring and other kinds of things which are not acceptable in our community, which for lots of good reasons, and in this setting is a difficult reason from the perspective of tracking and other things you need for good contact tracing and otherwise. And I think a third aspect has to do with the political environment that we're in. So even if we had planned well, and even if our health system was better, and even if people were okay with being monitored, our political environment is such that it's really, really, really hard to convince a certain group of people, and it doesn't really matter politically this way or that way, that it should become the highest priority. And I think I understand that, because in some ways, if you are dealing with economic crises, you're worried about food more than you're worried about getting an infection, or you're worried about a job more than getting an infection, which is a reality for a lot of people. I can see that, but that's not really what I'm talking about. What I'm really talking about is this really coded language of who gets sick, how people get sick, whose fault it is, this kind of structural communication, political communication, and racism and other things that are fundamental to the way that the conversation around COVID-19 has gone. That is deeply, deeply, like, in my mind, about the dysfunctionality of our political communication.
Yeah, I would. I mean, thank you for going to the political motivi. I think you summed it up very eloquently. I think, you know, to put it very simply, it's sort of in terms of our setting, belief in public health and what that is. I also think about other settings and what I think will be very interesting to learn, not from the political standpoint, but sort of lived experience and what people bring. And I was thinking specifically, Madhavi, you referred earlier to the Ebola epidemic in 2014 in West Africa, and actually thinking about, you know, that was so devastating to health systems there and really shone the light on lack of health systems and weaknesses in health systems in some of those West African countries. And then the flip side is some of their response, so much of their response was community engagement, contact tracing, believing in the science, believing certain, you know, the importance of surveillance and really public health and the good for the community. And while some of these countries are still, you know, reeling and rebuilding and recovering from that 6 years ago, they also are interestingly positioned to respond much faster than some other countries and other settings because of that experience. So I think, you know, the looking sort of at a country by country, case by case experience in a few years, I mean, I hate to say it, you want to act now, you want to be in the present, you want to do as much as we can now. But I think we're going to learn so much in terms of people's response. And I think that's an element of it, too, is really from the ground up, not just, you know, we could spend hours on the top down political conversation here. But I think, you know, trusting the people in the community to act accordingly, whether it's in San Francisco, New York City, Freetown, Sierra Leone, will be really interesting.
One other thing I would just add is that I think that one of the other aspects of our cultural dialogue, which I think is really relevant to global health, is that we don't often speak in a language of constraint. So one that the aspect of the conversation about Ebola, you know, none of the places that were hard hit thought that they had all the resources they needed to have. They already had struggles in their healthcare system and resource issues. And so they are always functioning with having to allocate in constrained environments. And the reality is we some of which is true constraints and some of which are, you know, structured constraints, live in a constrained environment. But we don't have the opportunity, or maybe don't make the choice, or don't have the environment in which we have to talk about making difficult choices. Now, individuals often have to do that, obviously. But as a system, we don't always do that. And I think, we can learn so much from our global health colleagues, our partners, because they're always having to make those decisions. And fundamentally, that's what our public health community or governments are doing. What decisions do we have to make in these constraints, both financial, economic, political, social, other constraints? And, you know, it's really hard to have that in a time of high intensity stress, as well as, you know, real danger for people's lives, if you've not been having that conversation very regularly.
Actually elaborating a little bit, so I'm curious, what are some concrete examples of differences between like low resource and high resource countries?
Well, I was talking a little bit earlier of how we're sort of learning from of the project we're working on in TB with colleagues who I've worked with for a long time in Mozambique, and it's and I really agree with the like we're the things that we take for granted that we don't think about resource allocation, we don't think about not having access to things here, whereas the conversations we've been having with our colleagues there, it's sort of a, you know, going from like, what basic PPE do you need to, is there water to wash your hands? If we want to recommend, you know, if we're doing contact tracing in Mozambique, to recommend people isolate, can they do that? I mean, it's just the really basic approaches, educational approaches to what resources there are. And honestly, I mean, just clean drinking, not just drinking, hand washing, in so many settings is not a given. So what do you do? With all the things that we are recommending people do here as basic public health prevention just isn't even an option. And it's not about moving around ventilators. It's not about the things that our systems are concerned with now and appropriate for the level for where we are, but really basic public health necessities for people being able to keep themselves safe. It's just a completely different conversation depending on the setting.
I think I might have one example that might feel concrete for us. That's a US focused example. So it relates to PPE and masks and CDC guidance early on. So, and again, this is not really about the CDC. It's about our communication around constraints. And we didn't have enough PPE. Could we have? Who knows? But we didn't. And so it made a lot of sense that we had to make decisions that were difficult about who gets it, how is it used, and the risks that individuals, health professionals, or otherwise were taking by using what in the end was probably suboptimal PPE. In addition, we decided to tell the public that masks were not helpful or that, you know, cloth masks or other things were just not a good idea. And really, I think we had inadequate information. Okay, so that's okay. And it's not always okay because people expect decision makers to have information to trust them. So I understand why you have to show or act like you have a lot of as much information as possible when you're communicating. Yet, if we had a culture of recognizing or if we had been able to communicate in the past about constraints, we could have had a totally different conversation. One, this is the best kind of PPE for everyone all the time that we could have. This is what we really have. So frankly, we have to ration, not a conversation that we can very easily have, although we have it for things like organs or, you know, organ donation and other things like that. But and if we said these higher risk settings get this, we know it's a little suboptimal, but other health professionals get this, so, you know, and we recognize you're taking a risk. If you can't take the risk, you know, whatever, public do this, et cetera, we would have had a very different situation. I don't know exactly what the outcomes would be. I mean, I wouldn't presume to know more than a lot of other people on this, but I do think that this is an example of how we talk about and deal with constraints and restrictions of resources that is really unfortunate because we had the opportunity to be more transparent and we had the opportunity to have a dialogue about what we value and what risks people are willing to take. But instead we sabotaged ourselves by saying, you know, these are not valuable. And then now we're telling people to wear them and why would they trust us? You know, and yes, maybe it doesn't have as much of a benefit as an N95, but we can't use N95s for everybody because we don't have enough, you know. So I think people can understand that and can live because, again, I think people make day-to-day decisions in constrained environments. You know, most people in our communities are deciding between, you know, food and clothing and school and other kind of things all the time. And so we could have done that. But I think it's a combination of our, again, it's not to blame any particular force, because if you already have to fight against people not even believing in science, and you already have to fight against people who don't believe that government should make decisions for them, or who feel like government's over controlling their decisions, or if you already are working in an environment where the information is changing constantly, you're at a disadvantage. And yet, if we had practiced, I think it would have been a slightly different setting.
How do you think this is going to shape our health systems moving forward?
I mean, I think people can't doubt anymore the intersection of public health and structural determinants of health and clinical outcomes. And, well, the proof has always been there, but this is a proof that everyone's feeling at the same time. And so I hope that we can have bigger conversations about, you know, supporting not even preventative practices, but, you know, holistic practices to keep people healthy, to talk about, you know, environment and access to safe spaces, like the ability, for example, to shelter in place or other things. So I think having had people be able to see the very direct implication of the structural failures we've had and the health outcomes, maybe we'll allow a conversation on what people on including all of those elements in future healthcare, but also on top of that, in recognizing the need to think about access for everybody in a different sort of way. So that's what I'm hopeful for. And then the other thing is, I think that the health professional community itself has come together in a really beautiful way. I think we've seen a lot of examples in the research world, for example, of people just sharing freely of data and of like plasmids and all this stuff and sending them around. So hopefully we can also do a lot more collaborative work and think about cross-country work and things like that in research and science as well.
Yeah, I agree with that, Madhavi. Thanks for giving me a minute to think about it. It's such a tough question. I mean, it's such a good question. I think I agree with you that we have really shined the light on some serious system failures and weaknesses, both in our health system and in our society. I think sort of forward thinking, I think a lot about, you know, if when we have a vaccine, and my optimistic thoughts is maybe we will have it figured out. I mean, but by the time we have a vaccine to distribute to, if we're focused just on the U.S. right now, to everyone in our society. And that is going to be, that in itself is a massive challenge. The optimist in me and the hopeful side is to say we've learned enough that when that time comes, we will be able to reach everyone in a fair, equitable way. Maybe we have learned enough about what our failures have been that we can fix that before this sort of second wave of trying to really protect everyone. But not messing up that opportunity, to put it bluntly, but to really capitalize on what we've learned and act on it.
The COVID-19 pandemic is exposing the shaky foundations of our healthcare system, but some of these faults were already evident, and many could have been avoided. With a renewed spotlight on public and global health, we may be able to learn from pandemic response failures and successes worldwide and work toward a better, fairer system here in the United States. Lives depend on it. This episode was produced by Ben Mansky and Nancy Kai, with help from the rest of the team at Carry the One Radio. We'd like to thank Dr. Madhavi Dandu and Dr. Elizabeth Fair for taking the time to speak with us. And of course, thank you to Kemi Amin and the team from the Institute for Global Health Sciences at UCSF for reaching out to us for this collaboration. This series would not be possible without their support. For more information and links to the music used in this episode, visit us at carrytheoneradio.com. And if you liked what you heard, you can listen to our other episodes by subscribing to our feed on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Stay tuned as we speak to more health leaders from the UCSF community in the coming weeks. We hope you all are safe and well, and, as always, stay curious.